Welcome to Ask a Doctor, what your doctor wants you to know with Dr. Virgie. Over the next hour, you'll learn valuable medical tips from health policy to personal finance and medical debt management. Now listen close and welcome your host, Dr. Virgie Bright Ellington.
Find out what your pain medicine doctor wants you to know. I reached out to Dr. Christopher Gay. Christopher Gay, MD, MBA, is the founder and board-certified anesthesiologist and interventional pain management physician at the Alaska Center for Pain Relief. After completing his anesthesiology residency and interventional pain fellowship at the esteemed Columbia University New York Presbyterian Hospital, Dr. Gay established the Alaska Center for Pain Relief in Anchorage, Alaska, to provide comprehensive solutions in the treatment of acute and chronic pain by using interventional procedures along with traditional conservative medication when it's appropriate. So, Dr. Gay, first, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And you know, you have to tell us a story about how an East Coast guy ended up in Anchorage, Alaska. You got to tell us a story. I know there's a story behind it.
It's kind of like the old Bugs Bunny cartoon when I think I took a wrong turn at Albuquerque. But
right.
The real story
Pismo
is...
Pismo Beach, right?
Exactly.
It was always Albuquerque or Pismo Beach, right?
Indeed. So I was working... So after residency and fellowship, I was in Northern Virginia. But to backtrack a little bit, in medical school at Chapel Hill, the head of neurosurgery was a Black male named Dr. Estrada Bernard. And I remember my last year in medical school, he made an announcement that he was leaving to move to Alaska. And I thought it was the most bizarre thing in the world that anyone would leave North Carolina to go to Alaska, but never thought much else about it. Fast forward after fellowship and working for about 5 years, I was working for a large practice in Northern Virginia and learned a lot of things there. But one of the things I learned was that private equity wasn't my friend in terms of taking care of patients the way I wanted to take care of them. And so I was looking for other opportunities and I got a recruiter ad from Alaska. And it was a bit interesting. And so I started looking around and I wondered if he was still in Alaska. So I did a Google search and I found him, and lo and behold, he was still there. I thought about it and I was like, well, when he left, North Carolina, he was, maybe a little bit older, but approximately my age. And he had a son that was about the same age as mine. We had a 4-year-old at the time. And so I looked him up and realized I did not know how to get in touch with him. And there was no real contact information on the internet for him. Other than a fax number at his practice. And so I went old school and wrote a letter and included my email and phone number and faxed that letter off to his practice and crossed my fingers. And lo and behold, he actually wrote me back. And he gave me the scoop on Alaska and said it was a great place if you could deal with the darkness and the cold. And I said, I can probably do that. And he actually invited me out to come for a visit and told me about the practice that was, had the ad out. And after looking into that practice, I didn't think it was a good fit, but we actually explored me working as part of his practice. And so he actually flew me out here and we did an interview and considered working as part of his practice, but it seemed like it was going to be, kind of a one-sided deal where me as a pain management provider, I do procedures that relieve pain or sometimes are diagnostic that can help the surgeons decide what surgery they need to do. So they would refer patients to me, but working within their practice, I wouldn't really be referring patients to them. On the other hand, other pain management providers in the community that would be referring patients to them would probably stop if they knew that they had an in-house pain person. So it didn't seem like it would be a good fit from that perspective. But I really liked it when I came out here, having lived in New York City for about 4 or 5 years and Northern Virginia for 4 or 5 years. It was a really relaxing pace, the people seemed really at peace, and it just was a very nice breath of fresh air to come out to Alaska. And went back to Northern Virginia and decided it's way too far away. I can't possibly move to Alaska. And everywhere I looked, nothing measured up. We looked in Texas, we looked in even Kentucky, we looked in Maryland, not too far away from where we were living, but something just wasn't right, and Alaska seemed to have all the things that I liked, even down to immersion programs for my kids there and language immersion from K through 12. And you wouldn't
necessarily
expect that.
What languages in particular were you interested in?
Well, at the time, my son was doing Spanish and my daughter was born just before we ended up moving out here. But they both ended up doing Mandarin immersion. So my son's been doing it for about 6 years now, and my daughter's going to her third year of Mandarin immersion. And so, but they also have Japanese, French, German, Inupiaq, which is one of the local native Alaskan languages, and a few others. And so it's really just impressive what they had to offer here versus a lot of other places that we looked. You had to travel quite a ways from where we would have been living to find these same types of opportunities. And so we just really enjoyed the community, and the job seemed like a great thing to do and a perfect time to try it. I figured if I didn't try it then, I'd regret it when I was old. So I said, let's give it a try. And it's been about 7.5 years and I'm still here and still loving it.
And the rest is history. You know, they say, they say that you don't regret in life. You don't regret the things that you do. You regret the things that you don't do.
I certainly would agree with that. That's all I could imagine is if I'm, you know, 60 or 70 and retired, and I think back, I wonder what would have happened if I would have moved to Alaska. Because, you know, everyone I told thought I was crazy to say, hey, I'm moving to Alaska. No one really thinks about moving to Alaska. But there's been a lot of opportunities. It's been, you know, my mother went from, hey, you know, she was helping us at the time with my son. She's living with us. And she said, I'm not coming with you. And by the way, you shouldn't go either. And then when the movers came, she's like, why are they packing my stuff? So you said you weren't coming. And she's like, well, I'll come for a month. And here we are now. She sold her house and she lives out here in Alaska, sold her house in North Carolina. She lives in Alaska. My sister moved out here.
No and, way. Yeah, wow.
It's one of the best kept secrets. So, you know, a lot of people tell me to stop telling people about it because they don't want too many people to come out. But I still think it's great. And I think anyone should just visit it once if you can.
So if you had to pick top three things that you like about Alaska and Anchorage in particular, what would they be?
Number one is the beauty. You can really, I mean, if I could take my Zoom screen right now and turn it, you could see, you know, snow-capped mountains right out the window versus when I was in Northern Virginia and New York, all you see is like either concrete buildings or parking lots. So the beauty of it, you know, the serenity of it, you know, you can drive 15 minutes and you're outside of the city and you're, you know, at one with nature. So that's kind of unbeatable. Number two is the lack of traffic. That sounds minor, but having lived in two high traffic areas, to be able to go and the worst thing is to get stopped at a stoplight once and have to wait. There's no such thing as a traffic jam here. That was huge for my peace of mind. And then just number three is just the people here. People are so friendly. It was weird when we first got here, everyone's used to seeing someone that you know running to someone in public and say, hey, we should catch up. Well, let's exchange numbers or let's catch up sometime or let's do dinner. And it never really happens. Here, people actually say that and they mean it and they do it. For example, one of our friends had gone fishing and they said, hey, I've got a salmon. You want a salmon? I'll give you a salmon. I was like, oh, great, thanks. They're like, hey, when are you going to cook it? I'm like, maybe next weekend. And they said, okay. I don't think anything of it. Sunday afternoon, I get a call around 1 o'clock. Say, hey, what time is that salmon going to be ready? And I was like, give me a couple hours. I rushed home and threw it on the grill. And yeah, people really make it a point to get together and, you know, enjoy other people and enjoy life. One of the other things is there's no shame about taking time off to go do things you enjoy. There's a donut shop here, a family-owned donut shop. And they're Muslim owned, or the family's Muslim. They take off the month of Ramadan every year. They close the shop. I don't think there's many other cities where you can close a place of business for a whole month, come back and be right back where you started.
And still have your customers.
Exactly. Yeah, and people respect that. Yeah, just because other people will close their shop and go hunting or go fishing. And everyone says, oh, it's fishing season. Of course they're closed. Or it's hunting season. Of course they're closed. And so it's just really the fact that everybody respects what everyone else enjoys doing. And it's just a place of kind of harmony and peace. And we also seem a bit insulated from a lot of the things that happen a lot of other parts of the country. You didn't see a lot of the same kind of racial tensions. You know, I won't say they're not here. I'm not that naive, but I say they're not as, you know, magnified as they are in some other parts of the country. So it's been a great place to live.
Can you tell us a little bit about the mention that you made of if you can handle the dark? So I was always curious about that. So do you spend, is it like 6 months of the year where the sun never really completely comes up? And then the other 6 months, it's always light. The sun never completely goes down. Can you explain that?
So I'll say it depends. And I say that because if you look at a map, most people don't realize how large Alaska really is.
That's right.
You could fit Texas inside Alaska at least three times easily. And you could, if you superimposed Alaska on the mainland United States, you could only fit that into the whole U.S. maybe three times. So it's a huge state. At the most northern parts of the state, absolutely. It's completely pitch dark for 6 months out of the year. And then during the summer, there's no darkness at all. Anchorage, where I'm at, is certainly noticeable, especially around the solstices, right? So in the summer solstice on June 21st, the sun doesn't go down. And maybe for a couple of weeks before and after that, you could go outside and 1 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, it'll look like an overcast day. It's not really dark outside. And you could read a paper without any light, or read a book without any light. During the winter in Anchorage, it doesn't get dark the whole day, but you can certainly lose a day if you don't get up, get out and get something, as Outcast would say. So you basically, if you're not out of the house by 3 or 4 in the afternoon, it's going to be dark again. And the sun doesn't come up until about 10:30 in the deepest parts of winter. So you only get about, maybe 10:30 till about 3:30, 4 o'clock, in late December. And then it's dark again. So for the most part, it's not a big deal, except on weekends. Even when I lived in Northern Virginia, I went to work, with the traffic, I had to leave so early, it'd be dark on my way to work. And by the time I got out, it'd be dark on my way home. So during the week, not a big deal. But on the weekends, you certainly notice that if you want to go and do something, it's like, oh, it's 9 o'clock and it's still dark, or it's 5 p.m. and it's pitch black outside. So it does make you appreciate the snow, because that certainly brightens things up from the light reflection.
The reflection, sure.
Yeah, okay. So people actually get a little bit sad.
I never thought I'd hear anybody say that who's not like a ski buff.
Right.
I never thought I'd hear somebody say, it makes you appreciate the snow.
Certainly. And I don't really like the snow.
Exactly.
With that, it's like, hey, it's not so dark. I can actually see now, and yeah, I'm not your stereotypical person to say, I love the snow and I love this. And I'm not out really hunting and doing all that stuff, but I still love it out here. And so if you love those things, it's all the better.
Good to know. So yeah. You have to tell me, what made you decide to go to medical school? When you said, okay, I want to go to medical school, did you think I want to be an anesthesiologist? What brought you to your journey of being the painless Alaska guy?
Well, Virgie, let me tell you, it was an interesting pathway, and it's similar to Dr. Cooper, who was on a few shows ago with you. When I was young, my father died when I was 15, and that was one of the things that really solidified my interest in medicine. He had leukemia, and so he died early. He was 50 years old when he died. He was diagnosed at 45, and so spent a lot of my time going to doctor's appointments with him, and then at the end of life, going to the hospital. I felt a calling towards medicine at that point because I just felt it was something I can do to help others. It later became apparent to me that helping through pain management was something that I couldn't offer him, and that, with people that have leukemia and cancer, pain is often one of their biggest complaints. And so I was very happy and fortunate that I was able to later get into this field. But that really was the first, I guess, entry into medicine. I spent a lot of time doing that. And, when I got into college, I just kind of had already decided I want to go into medicine. So it's actually to connect a few dots. When I got into, I went to Duke for undergrad, and I was planning to be pre-med, and I met another friend of my brother who was interested.
How many brothers
medicine.
And sisters do you have?
I have one of each. And my family dynamic, my brother is about 2 years older. My sister's, well, I don't want to give her age, so she's older. So,
and where do you fall in?
I'm the youngest.
The youngest. You're the baby. So, okay,
I'm the baby, and some would say the favorite. But
yeah, I was going to ask you, are you spoiled? Tell the truth.
All right, I wouldn't say so, but they might.
But
say
yeah, we'll
so.
Have to ask them. Okay.
All right, but so one of my brother's friends, they knew I was interested in medicine. He was as well, and so he came over and said, hey, I want you to meet this guy. So I was a sophomore or freshman in college. And he said, let's go over to Chapel Hill. There's this doctor over there you got to meet. Lo and behold, it was actually the same neurosurgeon that I said was the one that I followed here to Alaska.
No way.
Right. And so, yeah, he took me over to meet him and he told me, hey, you're at Duke. I have a colleague over there. You should go and meet with him. And he set me up with another doctor at Duke to go and shadow. And I knew then and there I didn't want to do neurosurgery. They spend all day staring at this little small spot. And I was like, this is not for me. But it was good to, you know, read the studies on neural tube defects and the developments of this. But I was like, hey, this is not it. But I thought I was going to do primary care. Quickly figured out once I got to med school and had done a few rotations that I didn't like doing primary care. But I did enjoy the subject matter. I enjoyed all the diseases that present in primary care. I just felt like it was, to me, it was like watching a sport that you enjoy, but watching it in slow motion because, you know, and probably for others, like an emergency medicine physician, they probably feel the same about, you know, what I do, you know, or what I did when I was doing anesthesia. But I enjoyed, you know, learning about the medications, treating diabetes, treating heart, you know, heart disease, all this stuff. And that all kind of came full circle with anesthesiology. And so I just happened to meet an anesthesiologist at a, you know, function at med school. And they said, hey, you should come shadow me. And I came and shadowed. And then I was like, wow, I actually like this. And so I started doing, you know, a few more rotations in anesthesiology. And then during my last year of med school, I ended up doing a rotation in the pain clinic, which is a subspecialty of anesthesiology. And I really enjoyed the interventional side of that. And so I ended up getting into residency at Columbia. And when I was there, I did a program where you do additional research. It's called APGAR Scholars. So you commit to doing extra research and you commit to doing your fellowship there. So I did that. And so I got to basically do kind of like a mini fellowship my last year residency where I'm doing only like 6 months in a pain clinic. And so we do that. And then I just really kind of enjoyed the kind of the return customers, right? So with anesthesiology, what I felt I was missing there was something that you get in primary care where your patients come back and they remember you and they say, hi, I'm doing better. Anesthesiology, they wake up and they're like, see ya. And right. You never see them again. Right. But with pain management, they do come back and they are feeling better and you kind of get that short-term and some long-term gratification. So it kind of rolled all the things I liked into one, where you're managing disease states, you're dealing with pharmacology, and I enjoyed all of that. We also get that, you know, patient interaction, that one-on-one patient interaction, and, you know, you develop these relationships over time. So it was just a great fit for me. And then just being able to help people live their lives, you know, with less pain just certainly is very rewarding.
So what made you decide to get an MBA? What were your goals with getting an MBA?
So, yeah, so that came later. So a lot of people will do like a combined program when they're doing their, you know, medical degree. I didn't really have any intention to own my own practice when I was in medical school. It wasn't until after I came to Alaska and I was, you know, owning my practice. I'm trying to remember, I got involved in a program with Goldman Sachs, 1,000 Small Businesses. And when I went there, it was just really interesting kind of finding out more about the financial side of, you know, back, you know, accounting and things of that nature. And I was like, wow, I really, just for the sake of my own knowledge, it wasn't that I wanted to get it to kind of put on my resume to get a job or anything like that. I just wanted to be able to run my business better. So I did an executive MBA through an online program through Quantic School of Business. And it was very useful to learn kind of in depth more about, you know, in finance and the management of businesses and things of that nature. So it was a rewarding experience to do that as well. But again, it was really just to enrich me and help me do my job better because I wear multiple hats here, being an active physician and also to practice, you know, man, president. And so all the financial decisions I end up making and or signing off on. And then once we added another line of business, I don't think I mentioned it yet, but my wife is a physician as well. She's a gynecologist. And so when we first moved here, she was working for another gynecologist in town, and then she kind of developed a dream to build her own brand. And so she wanted to do gynecology only. So she stopped doing obstetrics. She didn't like being woken up in the middle of the night as much. And so she stopped doing obstetrics and started doing gynecology only, and then started her brand and dream, which was to do cosmetic gynecology. So she, you know, does makeovers, I'll say, or as, you know, if you compare it to Obama's stimulus package, if you like what you have, you can keep it. If you don't, you can change it. And so they come in with pictures and say, I want this. And she gives them that. And so that was a very different line of business from what I was doing. And so kind of making sure we were kind of doing things correctly with that and getting machines and, you know, appropriate equipment and financing and things. I just felt the MBA was very useful to accomplish those goals.
You know, there's a lot of myths that I think the public lay people have about physicians and finances. And one of them, the number one thing is, you know, I think that still many people don't understand that physicians don't have any control over the United States healthcare system, period. We lost it decades and decades ago.
Right.
And the other thing is that we are not taught not one iota, not one day, not one class on how to provide healthcare in a financially efficient way. And exactly. We are definitely not taught anything about how to run a practice, which makes a big difference when you're thinking about long-term, how private equity, you said, you know, you left your practice because it was bought by private equity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of us are part of this hashtag, you know, take medicine back movement. Because, you know, if we had been taught, I think many of us have been taught if that was part of their curriculum in medical school, or and there's no residency program that teaches it either. It would make a big difference, I think, in more of us giving a private practice a try. Sure. But with the onslaught of, you know, private equity corporations taking over the United States healthcare system, you know, we'd have to be able to have the luxury and of time and or commitment to do an MBA program or learn about, you know, the business of medicine.
Right.
Of practicing medicine, what you were able to do, you're able to carve out time and commit that time. You know, you had a family, had young kids, but you said, you know what, I can help more people if I can run a practice efficient, start and run a practice efficiently.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
totally get that.
The school that I, you know, attended, we made it very convenient. It was an app-based program where, you know, you get a certain amount of time to accomplish all the modules and you do it on your own time. That was great, you know, and so that was, you know, very instrumental in me, one, choosing that program because, you know, things are busy. You do have a family and you got a business and you can't just say, I'm going to go there for 2 weeks and be away for 2 weeks, you know, at these intervals. And so, but yeah, at the end of the day, I was able to, you know, every dollar that I save allows me to treat more patients, you know, so if I don't have to carve down my time of seeing a patient as much, then that patient can get better quality of care. It's less likely I'm going to miss something if I can spend more time with them. And so the efficiency model that you mentioned is very important.
You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie on the Voice America Health and Wellness channel. We'll be back after this short break.
Are you one of the millions of Americans struggling with their medical bills? Now there is a way to get the healthcare you need and take care of your financial life. Dr. Virgie Bright Ellington is an internal medicine physician, and she's a determined patient advocate, helping people reduce and even eliminate their medical debt. Become a member today and discover how to free yourself from a lifetime of bills at crushmedicaldebt.com. Join the Crush Medical Debt community today. Sign up at crushmedicaldebt.com. You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie. If you have a question for Dr. Virgie or her guests, you can email Dr. Virgie at dr.virgie@crushmedicaldebt.com. Now back to the show. Here again is Dr. Virgie.
Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. So what would you say, Dr. Gay? What would you say? I'm really interested in hearing your opinion. What would you say your pain management doctor wants you to know?
The basic answer is that we exist. A lot of people don't know that, you know, what pain management is or that we're here. You'd be surprised at the number of patients that come and say, I've never heard of pain management before. So at the very basics of it is that, one, we are here. So then from there, I'd like to flesh it out and kind of explain what we do and kind of where we enter, right? So what we do is diagnose and treat pain, chronic pain conditions, or sometimes acute pain as well. But we kind of are a go-between between kind of primary care doctors and surgeons, right? So often the primary care will say, oh, you got a disc herniation on your MRI, you got to go see the surgeon. They refer them to see the surgeon. Surgeons are sometimes backed up and they might not be able to see them for, you know, weeks or months or a long time. Often the patient is, you know, having a lot of discomfort and, you know, maybe, you know, having worsening of their condition because of their disability due to pain. So we exist kind of in that middle space, one where we can help one narrow things down in terms of what is really causing the pain. Sometimes things show up and they're not necessarily the cause of the pain. There's a lot of structures in the back that can cause pain. There's, you know, the discs in the back, there's facet joints that can be cause arthritic pain, and the discs can bulge out and they can cause, you know, pressure on a nerve, and they can cause sciatica. People have heard of that, where the pain shoots down your leg. There can also be a simple tear in the disc, where if you do an MRI, on first glance, the disc may look pretty normal because it's not pressing on anything. But if you look closely enough, there may be a small tear, and then you can get a chemical irritation. And often those patients will have pain in their back, may go down the leg, but there's usually no sign of any compression of the nerve, which usually is, you know, as if you lay your arm on something for a long time and it starts to go to sleep because the nerve gets pressed, compressed. There's no disc in the back pressing on the nerve, so you don't get the numbness and tingling down the leg, but you may have pain because of that chemical irritation. Other structures, there's other bigger joints in the back, and those can certainly cause pain. And then certainly there's muscles all throughout the back and the neck and other soft tissues. And so one of the most common things that is overlooked is we'll see people that have had a motor vehicle accident, right? And they'll say, hey, I went to the emergency room. They did x-rays. Everything was normal. They may even do an MRI and everything looks normal. A lot of times those types of pain come from kind of soft tissue things that they're not at the level of full on inflammation yet, but you cause some small micro trauma that is causing those muscles to tense up. So people end up with what's called trigger points. And those are tight bands of muscle that if they're not treated early, they kind of develop connective tissue around them. And if you feel them, they feel like little knots under the tissue and you can rub across them and they really trigger pain. If you treat those early, you can prevent those, you know, bands from developing and people can largely do very well. So
are the bands, Dr. Gay, are the bands, development of those bands triggered always by trauma?
A lot of times by trauma, but sometimes by stress or ergonomics. So you might find someone that sits at a desk and, you know, maybe their desk is a little, you know, computer screen's a little too low and they're sitting like this, you know, so some patients benefit from what's called an ergonomic assessment, where they might have, you know, if they work at a big enough company, they might have HR come in, or they may order someone to come in and say, hey, your computer actually needs to be lifted up a little bit, or you need a better chair that supports this. You know, like I have can't see it here, but a little support behind my head. You know, those types of things that can change because, you know, you might get away with it for, you know, a few years, but if you work at this job for, you know, 20 years or 15 years, over time, these things will have their effect. But again, it might just be something simple like the muscles develop these tight bands, and often they're right above the shoulder blades, and a lot of people, they feel them, they're right there, and they're always surprised. Like, how'd you know? That's where I hurt. It's like, this is what I do.
That's so, my job.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so things like that, where if patients knew about that, they would know to come see us versus taking the answer of, oh, there's nothing wrong, just go home. But they know they feel pain, and, you know, there's a provider telling them, hey, there's nothing wrong with you, there's nothing we can do. And then, unfortunately, some providers are, you know, accommodating, and they say, hey, well, they say they feel pain, I'm going to give them hydrocodone. And then that worsens the little drug epidemic, right?
It goes down that rabbit hole.
Right. Because they feel better and then they want to ask for more. And they kind of just end up in this cycle where they're getting medications or something that could actually be treated. And so knowing that we exist, knowing that we are an intermediary between waiting for surgery and also an option just for evaluation to figure out what might be going on if you're told, hey, there's nothing wrong. A lot of times it's just that whoever might be seeing you may not have, you know, seen these other conditions before. or the imaging that they've ordered may not actually assess the area that's causing the pain. Often there's something called the SI joint or the sacroiliac joint, which sits just beside the lowest part of your back and just below. So sometimes that lowest part of your back can be this source or it can be this joint that's right there. But the x-rays usually cut off right at that junction. So you can't see it.
That's a good point. You know what? I never thought about that.
Yeah. And so, but again, you know, what we do is, you know, we hear it all day, every day, but I get used to certain patterns and people tell me, oh, you know, I'll have pain mostly when I get up out of chairs after sitting there for a long time and I get in and out of chairs, or if I go up and down stairs, or if I try to roll over in bed and I start thinking it's the sacroiliac joint. Or if they tell me, hey, you know, when I'm standing in the grocery store, that's when it bothers me the most. And I might think that's the facet joints in your back. Or if I'm sitting at my desk, that's when I have a lot of pain. And that makes me think it might be a tear in your disc. And so we hear these things with the frequency that makes us think of what it might be versus, you know, like a primary care. And they hear something, just for instance, a few weeks ago, I had a sore throat and I looked at it and it was red and I thought I had the plague or something. And I, you know, called my doctor and they're like, oh, it's just postnasal drip. You have allergies. I'm like, I don't usually have allergies. So it wasn't something very new to me. I don't see it. I never look at allergies. I don't look at the back of throats like that. And so because I don't see it very often, I don't recognize something that's very routine to them. And so same with pain management, because we see pain all the time. Stuff that's very routine to us, we can pick it up quite easily, where someone else might either sweep it under the rug or just think it's not anything too significant. But again, you're feeling this and it's something that, you know, you want to get addressed. So you want to see a pain specialist to try to get to the bottom of that.
What would make somebody decide, you know what, I'm going to look up an interventional pain management specialist, a board certified anesthesiologist who has done a fellowship in interventional pain management, as opposed to, you know what, my back hurts, let me look up a chiropractor, get a referral, talk to a friend and see if they have anybody knows a good chiropractor. What's the difference? Why would somebody say, you know what, let me see if I can, I'm having pain, but in this case, back pain was a frequent issue. What would make them decide to let me see first if I can find a board certified interventional pain management specialist?
That's a great question. And I'm glad you pointed out interventional pain specialist, because you will see people that advertise as a pain specialist, but what they really are, you know, they're not trained in anything and they just do pills.
Yes.
What we call pill pushers. Pill pills.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't want to go there. But with the chiropractors, there's certainly a place for them. And I will refer patients to chiropractors sometimes as a adjunct to what I do. What we do primarily is, one, we try to figure out what the problem is. Two, it's usually something that's, you know, the result of some type of inflammation, which inflammation is, I often describe it as fire. You know, there's something that's on fire in your body. And then I describe myself, I'm the fireman. I'm going to put out that fire. But sometimes you need something to address what was causing the fire. So, you know, if there's some sticks that are rubbing together to start the fire and I pour water on it, that's great. Once they dry out, they're still rubbing together and that fire is going to come back. So sometimes you need someone to lay hands on it, adjust whatever is causing that. And that could be a physical therapist or a chiropractor, or even a massage therapist, to address these biomechanical issues or these structural issues that are leading to these pains or this inflammation. So certainly in that case, it's never wrong, I think, to start with an interventional pain specialist. And anyone that's good will tell you, hey, this is something that I can do something for, or I don't think you need my level of treatment. You can go and, you know, see these other providers. And if you don't get better, come back and see me. And so I do that sometimes. I say, look, it sounds like you're doing pretty good. Your pain is not that severe. I think if you do this, you will get better. And, you know, we have some, you know, chiropractors and physical therapists and other, you know, providers that we, you know, trust and work with. And we'll say, you should go see them. And we kind of stay in contact. I'll call them up and say, look, I have this patient. You know, I think this is what's going on with them. I'd like you to see them. And, you know, certainly they'll send them back if they can't make progress. But other patients, they come in and they are in such, you know, pain and agony that they're not able to function. You know, I've had patients that can't even cook their own dinner. They can't walk to their mailbox. And so a lot of these other treatments take a lot of time. So usually the chiropractor is going to be a number of treatments. Physical therapy is going to be, you know, several weeks of treatment to get to the point where you're having some type of relief. But again, if there's a fire going on in there, you got to put that out to be able to feel the difference. So certainly seeking out a pain specialist that's board certified interventional pain management is again, never wrong to do as a first choice. If it's something that just, you know, popped up, it's certainly fine to see your primary care. And a lot of times they know what it is and they can take care of it. But again, if they do their usual treatments and diagnostics and they don't come up with anything or you're not getting better, then it's fine to ask your provider to refer you over to someone that they trust. And so they should hopefully have a relationship with a local interventional pain management specialist and should be able to refer you. If not, there are a lot of places that do online telehealth consultations at this point where you can log on and they can get you set up or teed up, at least with the appropriate diagnostic study, so that by the time you come and see them, you can kind of hit the ground running and have whatever treatment you need. The other kind of big answer of who should choose to see pain, interventional pain specialist versus a, you know, chiropractor or someone is a lot of what we do is based on injections. So if you are deathly afraid of needles and you know, don't want any parts of a needle, then it may not be the best place to have an injection. Though there are ways of getting around that. There are sites of service. Some people do procedures in the office. You can also do them at surgery centers where you can get IV sedation and you won't even remember being there. So certainly you can explore different options and knowing that this will usually be the quickest path to relieving your pain is usually the best place to start.
Excellent. That's good stuff. Excellent stuff. Good to know. So let me ask you this. Let's say that your family member gets plopped down in the middle of Hawaii or Kansas, where they don't know anyone who's an interventional pain medicine specialist or interventional pain management specialist, an interventional pain specialist. Mm-hmm. How would they find a board certified? Can you take us through the steps of finding a board certified anesthesiologist who did a fellowship in interventional pain management?
Sure. It's a combination of things. The first thing is probably going to be a Google search to see who's in the area. But if you want to verify what their credentials are, you can also look on the American Board of Anesthesiology and you can look up anyone's name and you can see if they're board certified, and it'll tell you if they're certified just in anesthesiology, if they're certified in anesthesiology and pain management. So the American Board of Anesthesiology is where you'd look as your secondary search after you've narrowed down who's in your immediate area. That being said, there are a few other specialties that do pain management, or I'll say try to do pain management because I'm biased. Interventional pain management was born out of anesthesiology. So initially, anesthesiologists, of course, if people are having babies, they do epidurals for them. So someone got the idea that, hey, if we put a steroid in someone's back when they're having a disc herniation, this may help. So they started asking anesthesiologists between cases, can you come do an epidural steroid injection? And that's kind of how the field started. Since that time, neurologists, physical medicine and rehab doctors, which kind of deal a lot with like stroke patients and things like that, or some type of neurological injury. And to a lesser extent, psychiatrists, they certainly have a place for treating the psychological aspects of pain, but they can also enter pain fellowships and do pain management. So if you look at those three specialties, you know, anesthesiologists are doing, you know, procedures, central lines and IVs and different catheters from day one of their residency. Everyone else is kind of starting later in the game. So, you know, if you look at experience or if you ever read about Malcolm Gladwell's, you know, outliers and 10,000 hours, you probably want the person who's had the most hours sticking needles in people to do your injection. So, yeah, so I would personally choose an anesthesiologist if there's absolutely no one else around and you take what you can get. And so hopefully no one crucifies me for these comments, but, you know, I am biased. I am an anesthesiologist and board certified in both specialties.
Well, you are allowed to have your bias. So are you saying that there are board certified physicians or physicians who are board certified in specialties and then decide for whatever reason they want to do a fellowship in interventional pain medicine or interventional pain management?
Correct. Yeah. So there are some that have done a fellowship, but again, prior to that, they haven't done much interventional treatment. If they've been doing it, you know, for 10 years after fellowship, they're probably, you know, pretty good. So I wouldn't shy away from them. But if, you know, Hey, just got out of fellowship yesterday. You know, I was like, I don't know. I might go to the next option in town. But you can look those up. And so each specialty, of course, has their own specialty board. So if you see that they're neurologists, you can look up and confirm that they're board certified. And often, depending on where they did the fellowship, their fellowship may still be through the anesthesiology board. So you may have to look them up on the anesthesiology board to see if they are board certified too.
If you're enjoying the show and you find something helpful, let us know. If you're listening on Apple, hit 5 stars, leave a review. Let folks know what you found particularly useful. If you are watching us on YouTube, hit the subscribe button below and give us feedback. Let us know what you think, what you found valuable. When you share your feedback, you're helping a lot of folks. And today's Cousin Richie Jr. joke of the week. Cousin Richie Jr. asks, what did one math book say to the other math book? I've got a lot of problems. Okay. All righty. So please, if you have any, if you have any other jokes that you'd like to share, please, 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 please send them to david@crushmedicaldebt.com. You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. We'll be back after this short break.
Are you one of the millions of Americans struggling with their medical bills? Now there is a way to get the healthcare you need and take care of your financial life. Dr. Virgie Bright Ellington is an internal medicine physician, and she's a determined patient advocate, helping people reduce and even eliminate their medical debt. Become a member today and discover how to free yourself from a lifetime of bills at crushmedicaldebt.com. Join the Crush Medical Debt community today. Sign up at crushmedicaldebt.com. You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie. If you have a question for Dr. Virgie or her guests, you can email Dr. Virgie at dr.virgie@crushmedicaldebt.com. Now back to the show. Here again is Dr. Virgie.
Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Gay, there was something that we were talking about that I wanted to make sure folks heard about, and that was the pain scale that we're told about now when we go to see a doctor, when we go into the hospital. They ask us about our pain on a scale of 1 to 10. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because it has a lot of impact on what we're calling the pill-pushing opioid crisis of the last 25 years.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that back up. This is a very important topic for a number of reasons, and it's confusing to a lot of people. It's funny. I was actually talking to my sister a few weeks ago, and she said, hey, you know, they always ask me this, and I never think much about it. And I was explaining to her that a couple of things are affected by the pain score. One is the insurers may or may not cover certain procedures for you based on what level of pain you reported or how much your pain level changed after your initial procedure. I didn't say it yet, so I won't say it again, but it is very individual. So a lot of people come in and they minimize it. They say, well, my pain, I have a very high pain tolerance. So, you know, my 4 is like somebody else's 10. And so I'm going to say I have a 4. It's really about what your pain level is for you. So, cause it's comparing you over time. So if you came in and you had a pain that was, you said it was 8 out of 10, we do an injection. And you come back and you say it's 4 out of 10, and that's a 50% reduction. And so some insurers really look at the percentage reduction to determine whether you can proceed with the next step in therapy. So some procedures that we do require an 80% reduction in your pain. And that's really huge. I think that's a little ridiculous, honestly, because, you know, if your pain's a 10 and you go down to a 3, that's only 70%, but that's huge,
that's
a huge reduction for most
people. That's a big relief, yes.
Right, but they'll say that's not enough, but again, it's really important to really not minimize what your pain level is and then not minimize what your pain reduction is and then also to separate out any pain that you're having coming in versus sometimes we ask your pain score when you leave that day, even after procedure, if you have any new pain that's from the procedure, to really separate that from whatever your initial pain was. So if you say, oh, I'm a little sore from the procedure, a lot of times patients will also average those pains together. So I've had some where they'll come back and say that 70%. They'll say, I had 70% reduction. Or they say, my pains are 3 when I'm leaving. And I'll say, oh, I'm sorry, you can't have the next step in the procedure. And they're like, but why? My pain went away. It's like, but you told me your pain was a 3. And they say, well, I was really just talking about, you know, I felt a little sore from the procedure. And so that's what I was talking about. So it's really important to be as specific as possible and to kind of focus on the pain you have coming in the door. That's the number we want to use to describe. That's what we want to describe using the pain scales, what number you have when you came in or what you usually are used to having and how that pain changes after the procedures. And then also not to necessarily lump in different pains. If you have back pain and shoulder pain and knee pain, then please, you know, elaborate on my back pain is a 5 out of 10. And you can tell us specifically it's 5 out of 10 when I, you know, walk through the grocery store, but when I sit down, it goes away. My shoulder pain is a 4 out of 10 when I reach up, and it still stays at a 2 when I'm doing nothing. And so just be as specific as possible, because that's going to help you get the treatments that you need and get coverage for the treatments that you need. And then just really help us to determine how much improvement you're having. Another example, I had a patient once where we did a procedure and we did a follow-up visit on a video like this, because you can do those right now these days. And so I'm talking to him and I was like, you know, so we did a procedure at the last visit, you know, what's your pain like? He said, oh, I have no pain. I said, oh, great. And then it's like, okay, you can proceed to that next step, which gives you, you know, similar reduction for the last 6 to 9 months. And so we proceeded on.
Apologies, Dr. Gay. Can you say that again? So he said okay, he had so no pain and you told me go to the next step, which is.
Right. What? And so there's a procedure that, you know, we do kind of a diagnostic procedure. It doesn't last very long.
Okay.
So that's kind of a test procedure to see if they would be a candidate for something called radio frequency ablation. Mm-hmm. Some people call it burning the nerves, is what, you know, commonly referred to as. So if you get enough relief from the first one, even if it makes your pain go away, presumably it's going to come back. And so he said, oh, I have no pain, which means the procedure worked remarkably, 100%. I was like, great, 100% relief. You can have that other procedure. We progressed to the other procedure, and then he says, oh, it didn't work. You know, I have pain when I walk around. And so we kind of scratched my head a bit. I was like, well, you told me before you had no pain. He's like, oh, well, that's because I was sitting down when I was talking to you, and I never have pain when I'm sitting down. And so it's like, again, it goes back to being specific, like, tell us about the pain that you normally are complaining about or presenting about. That's the pain we want to know about when we ask about your pain score. So that is the other take-home point about what your pain doctor wants you to know.
Awesome, awesome stuff. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you again for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to today's show. We hope we have given you some helpful tips to guide you through your medical journey. Until we talk again, have a beautiful week.